We are very thankful to have Rich Bledsoe as our conference speaker this year. For those of you who have heard Pastor Bledsoe before, you've undoubtedly come with a measure of excitement and eagerness. And for those of you who are getting the Bledsoe experience for the first time, you're in for a real treat. By way of introduction, Richard Bledsoe is an ordained pastor in the Presbyterian Church in America. He pastored Tree of Life Presbyterian Church in Boulder, Colorado for 20 years. He is a graduate of Westminster Theological Seminary in Escondido, California, class of 84, with a Master's of Divinity. Prior to that, he graduated in 1972 from Colorado State University, and he more recently received his Doctor of Ministry from Backe, is that correct? Backe Graduate School in Seattle, Washington. Since stepping down from the pastorate, Dr. Bledsoe earns a living by being a chaplain at Boulder Community Hospital and also being a chaplain for a small hospice owned by Accent Care Corporation. Dr. Bledsoe is a regular speaker at the annual Biblical Horizons Conference, and that's where I had the pleasure of meeting him for the first time a few years ago. And some of you know that the BH Conference is held near Destin, Florida each year. And I heard a rumor that Rich is able to do more pull-ups than the lifeguards on the pull-up bars at the beach. I've never personally witnessed, but it's only a rumor. I don't know if it's true or not. Rich is also a frequent speaker at various churches in his own locale and is currently teaching a class on the nature of the church and the kingdom of God at First Presbyterian Church in Boulder. He recently contributed a chapter to the Fetch Shrift in honor of James Jordan, entitled James Jordan, Rosenstock, Husey, and Beyond. Rich has been married for 35 years, has three grown children and one grandchild. Please join me in welcoming Rich Bledsoe.
Thank you, Joe, and how lovely to be here. I really have an apocalyptic title here. Of course, that's what I'm going to talk about is the rapture, and it's very near, as you all know, and I'm here to help you get ready for it. So we'll have fun, and if you go right through the ceiling while we're here, I won't be a bit surprised. It'll be. Isn't that what you expected today? All right, so we're here to have fun. Well, this is actually an appropriate title for this conference, because at least it's what I want to wend my way around to. We are in some sense at the end of a world, and I'm looking for. I actually brought my own markers as well, as so we're loaded here tonight, and I will probably scrawl on this board a lot. One of the reasons I like to teach theology is because it gives me a chance to draw a lot of pictures, pretty pictures, and I'll probably be doing a lot of that. So here we are. We all know that in the Bible, when we look at the Old Testament is full of a number of epochs or ages, and what do we generally call those? And we do call them ages, but there's a more typical word, especially in Reform circles. Well, that's not in Reform circles. But it's not a bad word, but it's not the word I'm fishing for.
Covenants.
Number of covenants. And we can trace the development of history through the development of various covenants in the Old Testament. And one of the things we have to do, you know, and you look at the New Testament. The New Testament essentially ends with a particular. I'm going to interact with you here a considerable amount. So I'll be fishing for answers, and I'll see if I can draw them out of you. But there is a particularly large event that the New Testament more or less closes with. Can anybody tell me what that is? Yes, 70 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, that is, of course, when we look at Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, when you read those passages, it's very understandable why people would say these are prophecies of the end of the world. And really, they are prophecies of the end of the world. They are more directly and more immediately about the destruction of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is a type of the world. Since that is where the temple was, and since Jerusalem was in a real sense the center of the world, when God has his own armies move in and destroy Jerusalem, it is a type of the end of the world. So it's not wrong to say that Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 21 are prophecies of the end of the world. They're a type of the end of the world. It is about the end of the, if you will, the old dispensation, and God is inaugurating a new testament, a new covenant, which fulfills all things. But the New Testament compared, what we call the New Testament, is comparatively speaking pretty short. It's about like this. You compare it to the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, it's a whole lot longer, as we all know. The New Testament is relatively short, comparatively speaking. And it really, if you take certain passages, for example, a passage in 2 Timothy that says, well, in the final age, men will be, and then Paul goes on to name what the last days will be like, and the things he describes are so horrific, swollen with conceit, haters of fathers and mothers, killers, kidnappers, adulterers, and he just names all these horrific, terrible, awful things. And you think, if this is a prophecy concerning the entire rest of the church age, then what you're looking at is about, so far it's been 2,000 years just like this. It's just getting worse and worse and worse and worse, right? You following me? If in fact when Paul says in the last days we can expect, and he names all of these horrible things, and he's actually describing his own era, which will culminate in 70 A.D., that is a kind of end of the world, but he's not describing what's then going to be inaugurated and happening until, if you will, the second coming of Christ, and we have not just the type of the end of the world, but we really have the culmination and fulfillment of all things. Are you following me? I don't want to go too fast here. You're all following this. I know you're all pretty much up to speed on the prophecy boat. And as you can see, I'm probably not going to be telling you about the rapture here anytime soon. But what we're looking at is, in a certain sense, the New Testament culminates with 70 AD, and therefore, how are we going to have any insight into what the rest of the, what we sometimes might call the church age, what is the rest of history going to look like? And if we want to know what the rest of history is going to look like, then we really have to go back and look at what we call the Old Testament. And what we see, I think, is a recapitulation of a number of elements in the Old Testament. So the Old Testament is what will tell us something about what we see coming in the coming era of the church, which follows 70 AD and the end of the Jewish reign. Now, Paul, at the end of Ephesians chapter 3, this is actually the passage I will be teaching on when I preach here on Sunday, but he says, it's often used liturgically a lot when we talk about, how does it translate usually? A world without end. You will often hear that phrase. The word world, if you go back to the King James era, or if you go back to the time of Shakespeare, now the word world is a world that is almost completely spatial. Right? It has to do with this planet Earth, another world, Mars, and we're going to write science fiction about it. Another world would be Venus, and often some other galaxies, all of these different worlds. But in the time of Shakespeare, or the time when the King James Bible was translated, the word world had a whole lot more to do with time. I suppose it had spatial connotations, but it had temporal connotations that it doesn't have now. So let me give you a contemporary example. About 10 years ago, I had the great privilege of teaching theology in India for a semester. You get on one of these giant airplanes, and you land in Germany, and then you have a little layover, and then finally you land in New Delhi, and you get off the airplane in New Delhi, and you are in a different world. Now, I don't just mean you're in a different world spatially. What you have immediately done, really, even in that airport, but especially when you get off that airplane, you leave the airport, you get in a taxi cab, and people drive there like you've only seen this in an Indiana Jones chase scene in the movies. That's how everybody drives. And you get out of the city, and you get into the villages, especially by then. Yes, people have cell phones and people have computers, but you're in a world that is about 3,000 years prior to our world. And these people live temporally in a completely different place. You drive down the street in New Delhi, and the taxi driver has little idols on his dashboard, and he believes in these things. Now that is a feat, or that is a spiritual or mental operation that you as a Westerner are incapable of. You can't do that. They do. They believe in these things. I mean, they are gods to them. They are not just little plastic or whatever up on their dashboards. They are actually connected to an entirely different kind of cosmos than we live in. And what it's all connected to is time. Because these people are only now, in the last 100 years, beginning to experience time as Europeans and as North Americans experience time. And what we have done is we have traversed this full 3,000 years, and now they're catching up almost overnight. But they're still way behind. They live in a different world. So Paul, this phrase that is often translated world without end, at the end of Ephesians, the literal translation of it is we are now living in the age of ages. That would be a literal translation. And you will find that in the manuscript notes in some of your Bibles if you have a good study Bible. Now, what would that mean? Paul says we now live in the age of ages. Which age do we live in now? Whose age is it? That's right. What I say to people sometimes when I'm teaching, and when I say this, and I come from Boulder, Colorado. Boulder, Colorado is not exactly the Bible Belt. And I say to people, you know, we right now are living in the midst, we have a world state right now. Do you know what it is? The United Nations? Global economy? Is it America, actually? No. What is the world state we live in? The rule of Christ. Jesus Christ ascended into heaven, sat down at the right hand of the Father, and he became the emperor of the world. See, let me just do this a little sideline. What's an emperor? Well, let's go through this. Who rules a tribe? A chief. And the way tribes actually get transformed is a group of tribes are brought together, and then a very dominant chief will eventually step forward, usually through bloody warfare, and he will then be the chief of chiefs. The chief of chiefs. And what's a chief of chiefs? We have another word for it. A king. That's right. And then there are empires in the world, and empires are usually multilingual, and they're actually made up of many monarchies. So what eventually comes to dominate an empire is a king of kings. Oh, you ever heard that before? What's a king of kings? An emperor. So Jesus Christ is the emperor, world emperor, who has sat down at the right hand of the Father, and he is actually ruling now. And we are living in an age of ages. We live in the age of Jesus Christ, but just like the Old Testament has a whole series of ages, so the era of Jesus Christ in the New Covenant will be made up of a whole series of ages as well. And in each one of these ages, what we see is new development, new growth, and new glory that's added to old dimensions of old kingdoms. And we happen to be living in a time when we are coming to the end of an age. There is such a thing, and I think only Christians can say this. When we read secular historians, you heard the name Rosenstock Huessy, my hero. Rosenstock Huessy, great. He was a Jewish, half Jewish. His father was a Jewish banker. His mother was a Christian. He became a Christian when he was 16. Grew up in Germany before the First World War. Had his first doctorate when he was about 21. And was an extraordinary man, an historian. He left Germany the day Hitler became chancellor. He said he would not have one foot in Germany as long as that man was in power. It's a good thing he left because he was half Jewish. Came to America. Got a job at Harvard. They didn't know what to do with him at Harvard because he was qualified to teach in, I think it was, 8 departments. But he talked about God a lot, so they put him in the divinity school. But after a year, he didn't get along with his colleagues because his colleagues were all into being objective. And he said, there's no way you can be objective. You have to make known your commitments. And his commitment was as a Christian. Now, that's a lot of what... That's the sort of things people are saying now in universities. Oh, objectivity. Not in the old-fashioned sense, where you can just stand outside of yourself without any kind of commitment at all. So he left Harvard after a year and went to Dartmouth, which in those days was a cow school. Didn't amount to much. Taught there till he retired in about 1974, I think. And he passed away, I think, in the 80s or early 90s. Don't remember. But very important Christian historian. And why do they bring up Rosenstock Huessy? What was I talking about? Ages of ages. This is what he says. He says, well, if you don't have, just as you are lost in space, if you don't have a compass, so if you've got a compass that tells you which way is north, you're out in the woods, you can't tell, especially if you're in the jungle. In the jungle, you know there were people who lived in those jungles in Africa who did not know the sun existed. That's how thick the canopy is. You'd be lost. You couldn't see the stars, you couldn't see the sky, but if you've got a compass, you know which way is north. He says, if you don't have Jesus Christ, you are lost in time. You do not know where you are in time. Jesus Christ is the one who gives us direction and orientation in time. And Jesus Christ has carved out epochs or ages, and these are recognizable. Of course, we don't have biblical revelation to say this is precisely an epoch like you do in the Old Testament. But you can look at the Old Testament and say, well, we can see certain outlines that indicate that this is, in fact, an epic. And the epic that we have been living through, surely the epic that we have been living through, although one can probably not be exactly precise about it, but began about then. What happened in 1517? Yeah, Luther tacked up the 95 Theses, and the Reformation began in earnest. Europe was remade. And this consequently became a global covenant. Modernity grew out of this. The whole of the world that we live in today grew out of this. And now it is beginning to fall apart. It's been actually falling apart for a century, but it's hastening on. And the two great institutions that grew out of this era, anybody know what the two great institutions are that grew out of this era?
The state.
The nation state, which is a little different than, say, a monarchy. A nation state is generally based on some kind of written constitution, and it's much more rationally constructed than a monarchy would be. Monarchy, you still have immediate, almost familial connection to whoever your ruler is. A nation state is more impersonal, although it's usually a linguistic commonality. But the nation state is one of them. There's another great institution that matured and grew up in this period of time. Anybody know what it is? Yes, exactly. Very good. You get an A+ for tonight. University. Now, both of these are in terrible trouble. Boulder, Colorado is primarily a university town. Colorado University is there. Colorado University is not very different from most of the great state institutions in, not just in the United States, but in the Western world. It is increasingly incapable. It's very good at passing along hard scientific evidence. One wonders how long that can happen. It's true right now that if I go into certain professorial office buildings at Colorado University, and this would be true all over the United States, I go into the engineering building and increasingly all over in the hard sciences, and I walk down the halls, I do not see Anglo faces. What do I see? I see Indians and I see Chinese, Asians. I don't know if the American economy could even continue to really roll over the way it is right now were it not for the great influx of both Indians and Chinese and other immigrant groups. We are not reproducing ourselves intellectually even there. The university is still very strong in the hard sciences, but the humanities are lost. And it is the humanities that pass along the cultural heritage that our civilization is built on. And you cannot maintain a civilization without that cultural heritage being passed on from one generation to another. And for the first time now, we've reached now the point where it's not just a series of interesting, silly games being played in faculty departments. It's now reached the stage in America. We're governed by this. And we feel increasingly the incompetence and inability. We're really seeing the university is not capable of passing on the great cultural heritage that we have. And for the last century, the nation state has proven itself to be increasingly incapable of solving its own problems. We are, one fears, and things can always be put off for a while, but one fears that what we're seeing in the United States today is the same kind of cultural collapse that Europe underwent 80, 90 years ago. Now, right now, it's 2012. Well, you just think back, what would it have been like? You think, what would it be like to be a British gentleman in 1912? You're astride the world. You're the greatest nation on earth. You dominate everything everywhere. And you move forward 100 years, and Britain is a second world nation. And all of Europe is increasingly having harder and harder time turning itself over. And Europe would not be, I don't think, Europe would not even be in existence today had it not been for the existence of the United States. We've been the upholders of all of Europe for the last 50 or 60 years. Well, what happens when the United States begins to resemble Europe? Who's going to back us up? The Chinese? The Indians? No, I mean, we're really at the end. We're at the end. Now, you are doing something that is very difficult here. You decided you want to plant a church. You decided you want to have a new church. There is, I don't know if there's anything harder. There are probably some things as hard, but I don't know if there's anything harder than planting a new church. You all know that. Difficult. It's tough. Hard to get new people. You have great things happening, but still, you see, the habits of people are so entrenched. And I don't know what it's like here. I'm not from here. I'm not from a place that's remotely like this. Where I'm from, evangelism is very hard. I don't know if evangelism's all that much easier here. You'd have to tell me. I don't know. But it's hard to start something new. But it's good to be starting something new because we're at the end of all of the old things. And it's not just a matter of patching up the old things so they can continue to... Well, somebody has to do that. I mean, nothing ever disappears in the world. And if we move forward 400 years, denominations are, there's still going to be Methodists and Lutherans and Presbyterians and all kinds of things. They're still going to be there. Just like there are still Benedictines in the world. You know, there are all these layers in the Roman Catholic Church. And there's still Eastern Orthodox. Eastern Orthodox Church is everywhere. It doesn't disappear. But what God does is He puts a new layer on top of the old layer that revitalizes all the things that are below it. And you get to be part of a new world. And what you're doing here, even if it seems like a drop in an ocean, what you have to do is you have to do what you're doing by faith. And what you're doing by faith will, in fact, in the end, be that which creates a new world. All right? All right, so you see, we really are at the end of an age. And who knows what this is going to look like? One can hope for the best. One can hope we can avoid the horrors that Europe passed through in the last 70 or 80 years. Who knows? I don't know. I think, let me just skip ahead and I'll tell you what I think. I won't give you all my reasons for thinking this because it would just take too much time. But I think that we're moving, I'll say this very briefly, and then I'm gonna launch into talking about what I want to give you as an introduction tonight. But we are living in a time right now when the university and the nation state are on very hard times. These are not going to disappear. Nothing ever disappears. But renewal is not going to come through either one of these. The university is renewed. It's not going to be from within the great ancient universities. It's not going to come from Oxford or Colorado University or Harvard. It's just like if you go back 30 years, 30 or 40 years, you see the behemoth giant of the automobile industry in Detroit in the United States. You see General Motors and Ford and Chrysler. They're gigantic. Nobody can begin to touch them. Who is it that renewed the auto industry? Honda. Toyota. Nobody ever heard of them. What were they? They were little nothings. And that's the way it always is. Renewal does not come from the center of the great collapsing behemoths that we now exist in. It comes from little tiny places. And I think what we're eventually going to see, what we are seeing right now, is the whole world is I invented it if it isn't. It exists now. It is metropolizing. What do I mean by that? Metropolizing. It means that everyone in the world is moving into cities. Now, this actually happened in North America and in Europe 100 years ago. This is where the YMCA and the Salvation Army came from. The YMCA, still true if you go to the third world. I mean, here, I'm sure it's true here. And where I'm from, the YMCA, it's a place you go and work out. If you go to New Delhi, India, it's still really, really Christian. And you look up the hostel and the hotel where the YMCA, they will take care of you. And it's still really, really Christian. Salvation Army, maybe they had strange theology, but I'm telling you, what those people did and what they still do in revitalizing the poor in the cities. See, all these people were moving in from the farms. And they were tempted to promiscuity, drunkenness, alcoholism, getting into trouble, lots of crime. And groups like the Salvation Army and the YMCA grew up in England and in America. And it's because of groups like that our cities didn't just collapse and fall apart. But now this is happening all over the world. All over the world, every year in China, 30 million people move into cities from the country. Tim, what's the population of Canada? 30 million. The whole population of Canada every year is moving into cities in China. They have now 200 cities of 1 million people or more. 200. And this is happening everywhere. And these cities, increasingly what we see is that these cities are the concentration point of, if you will, the global economy and of the growing tribalism that we see all over the world. It's where they come together. And I believe that what we're going to see, the new layer that will be placed on top of this, will be the predominance of cities. What's the last great image that we have in the Bible? The New Jerusalem. We actually have a picture of two cities. What's the first city that we have a picture of? Babylon the Great. Which, if you're going to do an original exegesis, what is Babylon the Great? What is it really, literally? What was it? Tim? Yes. Try again. Somebody else. See, you can't trust him. You can't trust
Jerusalem.
Him. Yes, it's Jerusalem. It's actually Jerusalem. And the reason that you have to have a new Jerusalem come down out of heaven, see, it's there right now. If you have, the elect can see it. If you can't see it, you're not amongst the elect. You have to have special glasses. But if you look out there, the new Jerusalem has actually come down out of heaven, and it's floating, not quite touching the earth. And it's actually corporate headquarters. Do you know what the first corporation in the world was? It was not Sony or General Motors. Do you know what it was? The church. Church corporation just means body. The body, that's literally in common law where the idea of a corporation came from. It's the church. Church is the first corporation. Who here works for a corporation? Where are corporate headquarters for your church, for your corporation?
Right here in
Nashville's corporate headquarters. Who else works for a corporation? Where are your corporate headquarters? Where? Chattanooga. Okay. All right. Who else? Where are your corporate headquarters? Nashville. Okay. All right. If you work for Sony, where are your corporate headquarters? Pardon? Probably Tokyo. I'm not actually sure. But if you work for IBM, where are corporate headquarters? Yes. Okay, so you see, now, if you have a local office somewhere, you have corporate headquarters somewhere, but you have a local office, that local office has all the legal rights of corporate headquarters, right? That's how corporate law works. You actually fully represent that corporation right there. Corporate headquarters of the Kingdom of God or the New Jerusalem. This is a local office. That's what a local church is. It's a local office of a corporation, and corporate headquarters, you can see it if you look out there. Just come right down. The New Jerusalem. Now, I believe that is really what we're talking about here. The reason you've got to have a New Jerusalem come down out of heaven is because the Old Jerusalem is about to get smashed to pieces. And it would be unthinkable for these Old Testament believers to be existing in a world where there was not, if you will, a corporate headquarters. So John sees this great picture of the new corporate headquarters, the new Jerusalem, because the old Jerusalem is going to disappear because it's so corrupt and evil and vile and disgusting and decadent. God's going to destroy it. So new Jerusalem's coming down, so you're going to have a new corporate headquarters. All right. Now that's literally what it is. Sociologically, in our time, this is the picture, I think, of where we are going. These are pictures of cities, and we are moving to a time when cities, I believe, are going to become predominant, more dominant than even nation states. Nation states won't disappear. You'll still have Chicago, Illinois, the United States of America, or Shanghai, which is in China. Nation states aren't going to disappear. But what's going to revitalize? See, the nation state, you see this really powerfully in Western Europe, and you're seeing it. You're seeing this growing up in the United States. What's going to renew the nation state, say, in the United States? Well, right now, what you see in terms of renewal, the most interesting politicians in America are right now who? Pardon? I couldn't hear that. Okay. I'm talking about people actually ruling. He is typologically really, but actually, it's governors.
So it's governors in local, state, local, county, sheriffs.
Yeah. Yeah. But right now, the visible people really pushing back on the powers of corruption visibly that you can see are governors. People like Christie in New Jersey. They're actually disciplining the gigantic growth of the state. I think it's going to go even further down to county levels and eventually to cities. And mayors of big cities will become... That will politically speaking, become the source of regeneration. That's what's going to push back and recreate citizenry. So citizenry really means something. Recreate our capabilities of creating economies and wealth and so on and so forth. But that's where it's really going to come from. But the two pictures that we have of cities, and they're at work right now. There has been one other time in the history of the world when cities have become predominant. That was in the time that we call now the Dark Ages. Cities collapsed with the collapse of the Roman Empire. The passion of men for 1,000 years was to rebuild cities. But what was the model city in that era? There were actually a couple of model cities. What would they have been? Rome, Athens, Sparta, the classical world. We're going to rebuild the world. Not now. Who cares about Rome now or Athens now? Or Sparta? No. The real picture is going to be the New Jerusalem. That's going to be our model. And what we see in terms of what cities, both of these are at work in every city in the world today. They're both at work. This picture of Babylon, Babylon the Great, which is rich and powerful, ultimately trades in the souls of men and is decadent and corrupt and drinks the blood of the saints. That's one picture of the city, and that's at work in every city in the world, and the New Jerusalem is at work in every city in the world. And these two things are in competition with one another. But the great model, because everybody needs a model, something they can see, a type, and the great type is the New Jerusalem. Now, let's go down this road a little further. If you blink once in the Bible, the New Jerusalem, you see a great, glorious city. You blink again, what do you see? It turns, it's like it's transformed instantly. Boom, boom. Once it's a city, and you look again, it's a what? The bride of Christ. Now, sociologically, what goes along with this is the recovery of Christian marriage. See, right now what we're seeing all over the Western world is the collapse of marriage. In Europe, people have almost stopped marrying and having children. That's beginning to happen now here. And the recovery of Christian marriage, I think, is going to be really central to a sociological recovery. But all that can only happen under Jesus Christ. That's where I think we're going. Got an image of Christian marriage and the city, which is the bride of Christ. Okay? Have I now succeeded in completely befuddling everybody? All right. That's a little introduction. Now, I have 5 minutes, right? How much time do I actually have? Okay. All right. So let me go a little longer, and let me show you some things that about judgment. This gets us started. That tells you kind of what we're doing or where we're going anyway. If you look, what's the first world in the Bible? What's the first world? It's called the first world sometimes. Pardon? Well, you could say that. That's what he said was Eden. You could say that, but that's not what I'm fishing for. That's the same as Eden. Pardon? No. Try again. I'll give you one more chance, and then I'll have to tell you. For $1 million. Yes, that's $1 million. See me afterwards, you know. All right. The world before the flood is the first world. And that was a world in which people lived really, really a long time. It must have been a really different kind of world than we have now. I remember one time we were driving, we were doing these college trips with our kids, and we used to have this big, giant Ford van that was bigger than a boxcar. And I had a flat tire in the middle of the mountains in North Carolina. And I had one of those things where you put it on your tire, and it repumps your tire up, and then it puts all this gunk in your tire, you know, so it seals it. So we were able to get to a gas station, and this, I don't know, it was Mayberry. I don't know where it was. And we drove up to the gas station, and they were going to fix the tire. And I think everybody in town showed up to watch that tire get fixed. Now, this is a world where things go really slowly. That had to have been what the pre-flood world was like. You live 900 years. You know, ladies, some of you, I know some of you have pretty big families. You've got a window of time of maybe, if you really stretch it, maybe 25 years, 20 years, 15 years, when you can have all your kids. That creates a lot of stress, right? How would you like it if you only had a kid about once every 150 years? You know, this would be a stress-free world. Huh? So you see, what we're told in the curses is that one of the things God's going to do is speed up conception. It's one of the things it says. So he speeds up conception, but very gradually. It's actually not until after the flood that conception begins to really, lifespans begin to come down. Anybody remember how long Abraham lived? See, Methuselah lived 969 years. How long did Abraham live? 140. And he had six more kids after Sarah died. Yeah, with Keturah. So, see, what you can see is lifespans are coming down until we reach our time when, well, no, lifespans are going back up, but my mother's now, she's going to be 102. But that's really still unusual. And she's not having children, by the way, at that age. All right. So, lifespans come down to 70, 80 years, and the time of reproduction is really speeded up. God is speeding up history. There's more stress. Men have to go out and figure out how to make a buck so they can support all these kids that come really fast, and mom's pulling her hair out because what do you do with three, four, five, six kids in this really fast period of time? Well, you see, all these people before the flood, you know, when people get in trouble, sometimes we say they don't have enough to do. I don't think they had enough to do. So all they did was sit around and figure out how to become wicked. And what did God do? He said, I've had it. I'm cutting them off. There's going to be a flood. And he brings a flood. And he tells Noah, he says, I want you to build a big, giant boat. And on this boat, here, this is where theology is really fun. You get to draw. Okay? There's Noah's Ark. There's, you've got a window there. And here's a, yeah. And here's a giraffe here. And, okay. Okay. See, gollies. All right. And there are all these other animals, and he has nice animals on there, and he has mean animals on there. Now, who are some of the nice animals? Well, giraffes are probably pretty nice. Rabbits are pretty nice. Who are the really nice animals? Really nice animals. The really nice animals are sheep and cows and goats. And okay, now, if I put these up here, what are all of those? Oh, those are clean animals. Those are the nice animals. And how many of those was Noah supposed to take on board? Seven. Now, there's some really mean animals. Tell me some of the mean animals. Yes? A dragon? Komodo dragon. I think you're right. We're going to put a dragon up here. Okay. What else? Yes. A snake. Ooh. Snakes. What else? Pigs. Ooh, pigs. What else? What else? Spiders, yes. What else? Think of some really mean ones. Lions. Bears. Tigers. Ooh. We'll put lions. Bears. Tigers. Okay, now how many of those are you supposed to take on board? Two pair. All right, now let me ask you this. Who did these animals, these really clean, nice animals, who do those animals represent? It's a prophecy. Who would they represent? Well, which would be the who? The Jews or the Hebrews? The Hebrews. Okay, who do the really mean animals represent? The Gentiles. Now, see, what's interesting is later on, when God does create Israel, makes Israel into a nation, if I were to put up a map here, here's a map of the world, and this is exactly how it looks. Here's Israel right there. That's exactly how it looks. It's the center of the world. And up here, you have some really mean people that are called the who? Yes, the Assyrians. They are really mean. They make wallpaper out of the skin of their enemies. That's how mean they are. And down here, you have some really mean people. Who are they? The Babylonians. And over here, you have some really mean people. Who are they? Egyptians. Now, if you'll notice, these are all tigers and lions and bears, and these are all sheep and cows. Now, if you're going to have a grizzly bear get in a fight with a goat, who's going to win? The bear is going to win. So God surrounds these really nice, helpless little critters with all these really big, mean animals, and he did that precisely so they would have to trust him to protect them and take care of them. Alright? Now, he puts them all on this boat together. They're all there. And why did he put them all? What happens? Do all the mean animals make, do they have a bunch of nice meals with the nice animals? What happens? What happened? Anybody know? They all laid down and went to sleep. And they got along just fine. Now, what's that a prophecy of? Where's that? Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11 says, it says that, about the mean snake and everything. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the goat, the calf, the young lion, and fatling together, and a little child shall lead them, and a cow and a bear shall graze. The young one shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the nursing child shall play over the cobra's hole. What's that a picture of? Becoming what age? What era? The reign of Christ. When he makes the Jews and the Gentiles one. That's what the ark is. It's a big prophecy. It's a floating prophecy. It's actually a gigantic prophecy conference that went on for 40 days and 40 nights. And longer than that. They had to wait for the big prophecy conference. All right, see? And nothing about a rapture in there. They're big, stall, lay down, and go to sleep and get along. Now, later on, in about Acts chapter 10 or 11, Peter, who's a nice Jewish boy, and when he goes down to the grocery store, what section does he always go to? The kosher section. And he has never eaten anything. I mean, does he like bacon? No, he's a nice Jewish boy. And he has this vision, and this big sheet comes down out of heaven, and what's on that sheet? Well, there's, and groundhog, and all kinds of bacon, and all kinds of things. And God tells him to do what? He says, get up there and just kill it and just eat away. He says, I can't do that. God, I'm a nice Jewish boy. I go to the kosher section. God says, listen to me, boy. I'm talking to you. He makes that sheep come down, and he finally gets it. And what's he do immediately after that? He preaches to the Gentiles and he baptizes Cornelius the centurion, a Roman. And here we see the prophecy of the ark come true. Alright? Now, another thing that we see is that when all this is finished and this boat lands, God puts, he has a kind of sign. What's that sign? Rainbow. Puts a big rainbow up here in the sky. See? Just like that. Except it's in color. Alright? Just like that. Big rainbow. Nobody's ever seen one before, apparently. Now, later on, the rainbow doesn't go away. You actually keep seeing rainbows in the Bible. What's the rainbow stand for? Pardon? I'll never destroy the earth again. He makes a covenant with the world, covenant of peace. All right. Now, later on, and I know there's dispute about this, but we begin to see the rainbow keep showing up. Oh! Well, it's a good thing it's there. You know why? Because God looks down and he sees that and he says, oh, I guess I won't destroy the world tonight. See, this is what happens. Every morning God wakes up, gets his coffee, looks over the banister of heaven. He says, I can't believe it. Look what they're at it again. I've had it. I'm going to wipe them out. And he says, oh, that's right. There's a rainbow down there. I remember. I'm not going to do that. He sees that every day. All right. Now, in the Hebrew, actually, there is somebody, well, let me just give a little apologia for this, but there is, as things develop, God's going to develop one nation, which are the Jews, who are going to be the bearers of this peace, and the precursor to this one nation that's going to do this is a really dysfunctional family. Whose family is it? Israel's family. What was his name originally? Jacob. He's got 12 sons and one daughter, and he's got a couple of wives. He's got some handmaidens. I mean, you've got really all kinds of rivalries going on here. And they're all rotten except for one of them. They apparently all seem to worship false gods except for one of them. Which one is that? Joseph. And Joseph is given a coat, and this is all true in the popular mythology. What color was his coat? It's many. Now, actually, in the Hebrew, it doesn't quite say that, apparently. It says it's a tunic of authority. But the Septuagint translates it as many-colored. Luther translated it as many-colored. It's translated historically as many-colored. Probably the rabbis, this is just my supposition, there's probably a basis for this. The rabbis probably said there is a connotation in this tunic of authority of many colors. I think it's probably really there. I don't think that's just a myth. What do you think that's related to? A coat of many colors is a what? It's a rainbow coat. He has a rainbow coat. So he wears this rainbow coat, and it is a prophecy of peace that will be brought between these brothers who are all warring, who are all false idol worshipers, who are the sort of people you destroy the world over. All right? So this rainbow coat kid is actually the bearer of God's peace. And then you move on further in the Bible and you find that the high priest, when you get to the time of Moses, in the book of Exodus, we're told, given all these explicit instructions, the high priest is supposed to put on It goes over his whole, what do we call this? A poncho? That's not the word. It's his, on his chest, it has 12 precious, pardon? Breastplate, that's the word I'm thinking. See, I'm, the Alzheimer's setting in. So the breastplate has 12 beautiful precious stones on it. And each one of those stones represents one of the tribes of Israel. And when he goes into the Holy of Holies once a year during Yom Kippur to pray for God to forgive the sins of Israel, he goes in there, and that place is full of light. What happens when the light goes through those pretty stones? It makes a rainbow. So if you look in the book of Numbers, what you actually see is it's this. Book of Numbers, it tells us exactly what you do when they stop to camp. You put the tabernacle right there in the middle. And then, I can't repeat right now the exact order, but you've got these 12 tribes. The 13th tribe is Levi, but they're all spread amongst all the others. These 12 tribes are all camped out like that, around the tabernacle. The tabernacle is full of light, because that's where God lives, and God's like the sun. See, it's like, you know the joke about one little boy said to the other, "I'm going to fly to the sun." And the other one says, "You can't do that, you'll burn up." And he said, "No, I won't. I'm going to go at night." All right. So this tabernacle is full of light because God lives in there. And each one of these tribes is represented by a precious stone. So that light goes out of that tabernacle. And if you were up in the sky and you had a particular set of glasses on, what would you see? See rainbows. So God looks down on the earth and he says, "You know, that world is really wicked and vile and evil, but I'm not going to destroy it because I look down there and I see a rainbow. The Hebrew people are a rainbow." All right? Now, I want to point out one more thing, and then I'm going to wrap it up. Can I do one more thing? Okay. One more thing. Now, if we go back to the ark, what we see is that how many of the nice animals were there? 7 pair. How many of the mean animals are there? It's 2, isn't it? All right, 1 pair. That's not very nice. How come? What? They don't get to. No? How come you have 7? That's right. See, you think it's a really good deal to be these nice animals? Well, they get to be the ones who get to be sacrificed. Now, part of the reason that God doesn't destroy the world after that, doesn't just wipe it, he judges it so that the judgments produce a new world without completely destroying the old world. There's still judgments, not like the flood. The reason is because he's going to call out a particular people, and this particular people are going to be sacrificed for the rest of the world. Oh. So, we see, for example, this pattern all over the place. We see when Jacob brings his family, getting late, brings his family down into Egypt, how many of them come down? Anybody know? Why do 70 of them come down? That's right. If you go back to Genesis chapter 10, which is called the Table of Nations, it's after the flood. These are the sons and daughters of all the sons and daughters of Noah. And they begin to spread out over all the world. And you count up all those tribes and all those people, and it turns out to be 70. So wherever in the Bible you find the number 70, it always stands for the nations or the peoples. What's the number 12 stand for in the Bible? Pardon? The tribes of who? Israel. So it always stands for Israel, and 70 always stands for the world. So, in the Gospels, we find Jesus calls how many disciples? It's a new Israel. But in the Gospel of Luke, he sends out not just the 12, but he sends out what? 70. And the Gospel of Luke is the Gospel to the Gentiles, to the empires. So he sends out, he cares about the whole of the world, and this is we're told this in the number 70. So Jacob goes down into Egypt, and there's 70 of them. Well, now you see, by the time you get to this period in history, the world has gotten to be really bad and evil and wicked and corrupt and decadent, and it should just be wiped out. But God's not going to wipe it out. Instead, he's going to have these people go down into Egypt, and they are going to die for the world. So what happens to them? They go down there, and it's called a fiery furnace, and what happens to them? They're enslaved. It's like death. It's death. But then what happens? God calls someone called Moses, and what happens? Moses goes into Egypt, and what happens? The Exodus. And the Exodus is really the resurrection from the dead. So he calls his people out, they die for the world, and they are resurrected for the world. This doesn't start with Jesus. And then later on, if we think that's not exactly clear enough, we have, when the world becomes really wicked, evil, bad, vicious, and terrible, and should just be wiped out all over again, and in fact his own people have gotten to be really corrupt and decadent and awful and evil, what does he do with them? After Israel's been a nation for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, what happens? Sends them into captivity. First, the northerns go into the Assyrian captivity, and the southern kingdom goes into the Babylonian captivity. And lest we miss the point, when we read Ezekiel 37, 38, 39, what does it tell us? We have this whole vision of Valley of Bones, and the prophet is to breathe on the bones, and the bones come together, and the sinews come together, and flesh comes on the muscles come, flesh comes. We see a picture of a resurrection. So they come back out of captivity, and they go back to Jerusalem, rebuild the temple. What has really happened is they have died for the world, and they have been resurrected for the world. Now that's how God does it. He has a people that he calls. And it's because of these people that there is peace and not destruction. There is a rainbow. He has a rainbow people. And then he has a people who get to die for the world. And guess who you are? And we'll quit there. Okay? Thank you.